WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jim Gallopo has been working with the gangs of South Central L.A. since just after the Watts riots in 1965. He talked with us about his work a few weeks ago, but we wanted to hear more, so we've invited him back. Gallopo is a probation officer with the L.A. Metropolitan Specialized Gang Unit. He was in gangs and ended up in jail more than once when he was young. He was turned around by a devoted father and a probation officer who was willing to give him a break. Gallopo is a physically imposing man with a shaved head. He's white. The gang members he works with are black and Latino. Gallopo's been dealing with wars between the city's two main gangs, the Crips and the Bloods, since they began. Now he has a proposal to bring gang members into dispute resolution boards and other community leadership positions and training programs. I asked him if he could explain what the rivalry between the Crips and the Bloods is about.
What it's about, basically, they don't even know. The guys are killing each other over hassles that they weren't even born when they started out. And basically, like, the Crips were all consolidated, and everybody partied together and got along together, and then all of a sudden they were so large that they started having fights within their ranks, and then rival Crip sets started fighting each other. And, like, for good example, two of the gangs that I'm dealing with, the A-Tray Gangster Crips, which got famous in the Florence and Normandy and the Football Williams and all this type of thing, they have a feud that goes back almost 20 years with the Rollin' 60 Crips. And they are just as deadly enemies, and probably more so, than they are with blood gangs. They hate each other, and they have probably killed more. You know, there's been more killing between the Rollin' 60s Crips and the H-Ray Gangster Crips than there has between each of those gangs and blood gangs, you know.
What is that rivalry about?
Okay, the rivalry was over, it was a girl, it was a fight that turned into a killing, and then the gangs fell out, and it escalated over the years to the point where the story has it that there were two brothers living in A-Tray, you know, this within the last 3 or 4 years, who had been, you know, particularly aggressive with the Crips and may or may not have killed, you know, some Rollin' 60s, but, you know, it has it that they were creating a lot of problems in the 60s. So some of the Rollin' 60s organized to go over and get these guys, and they could never get the guys. So ultimately one guy in frustration, when they went over there, they couldn't get the brothers, they killed the mother, and that was a no-no. And now, like, part of the peace process that started about a year ago was bury the dead homeboys, is the slogan. We all got dead homeboys, we've all killed each other's homeboys, let's bury our dead homeboys and get along. That's fine, and it worked very well in Watts and Compton for a whole year. But it did not spread, unfortunately, all over the whole territory. But it did work in Watts and Compton extremely well. And those of us that work in the streets were trying to push this as a concept, bury the dead homeboys. And I had a leader of the A-Trays tell me, yeah, we can bury our dead homeboys, but we can't bury mama. You know, we cannot bury the fact that we just cannot forget that like we can warriors. You know, they consider a lot of themselves warriors.
The truce that started before the L.A. riots last year, that had to do with what you're talking about now, the bury the dead homeboys?
Yeah, well, basically, it happened, started about 3 weeks before the riots. And what had happened was we had in a very short period of time, maybe a week, maybe 2 weeks, 2 3-year-old little girls got killed in drive-bys where their father was the target. Separate, not related, separate gang areas, but it happened. And there were older guys in their 40s, early 40s, in the projects, the Watts projects, who had been around before the Crips and the Bloods started. These guys were basically tough guys that were not sucked into, you know, the Crip or Blood thing. But they ended up never matriculating. They always ended up staying in the same neighborhoods and all that. And people knew them and didn't mess with them, and they were not involved in gang activity. But you know, they couldn't go see each other. Like, let's say two of these guys were friends. One lived in the Nickerson Gardens, which is a blood project, or any other one lived in Jordan Downs, which is a Crip project. You know, they just couldn't go back and forth visiting each other and bringing the families over because of the fact that the youngsters might shoot them, you know. So they would see each other at liquor stores or in Will Rogers Park, and, you know, they'd just still talk. So a couple of them decided, when after these things, we're killing each other. We're killing each other as a race, and we got to do something about it. So they talked about, you know, the young, you know, how crazy the young guys were and all that, and they asked about, do you think you could get some of your young guys to meet with some of my young guys, and we could sit down and hammer something out? And there is a program called the American Program, run by the ex-football player, movie star Jim Brown. And he'd had his guys in all the Watts projects and in Compton for 2 or 3 years, trying, you know, to get something going. So the mechanism was down there. There were guys down there. And these guys ultimately hooked up and supported the older guys that were trying to get the thing together, and a number of them ended up going to having like a meeting where, you know, no doubt most of them were armed and all that. They didn't trust each other, but they met and nothing happened, you know. And from this, there were some guys that emerged as spokespersons and leaders. A lot of guys that were really sick of seeing, you know, not only black people killing each other, but, you know, the police coming in and just terrorizing, you know, all this. So these guys, you know, all worked together and ended up formulating, you know, a real desire to make, you know, to stop the killing. And I don't think they even foresaw how fast it would light on fire. There was a guy whose name unfortunately escapes me, that was a real bright middle 20s, I would suspect, black guy, who was going to school at one of the colleges, SC, UCLA or something. So he went out and researched peace treaties from history, and he found the Camp David Accord between Menachem Begin and Anwar Sadat and Jimmy Carter. And he saw that the formula would very well fit. So they brought this thing down. He reorganized it, you know, changed Anwar to, you know, all this, Egypt and Israel to this and that, and it worked. You know, there's a lot of things in there. So they brought that down and they had a framework.
The truce that got started before the riots, how well has that held?
There were gangs who never got involved in the peace, but most of them picked, even my gangs that I talked about, while they never were at peace. There was three levels. The first level was the peace Watson Compton, where you dated each other's girlfriends and hugged and partied together and drank together and all that. And then there was, and these are things I made up as names. The next was the truce level, where you could come into my neighborhood, with impunity. However, don't, you know, immunity, but don't stay too long. You know, you can come through. And that's all that, but no dating each other's girls, no party, and we won't shoot you, you don't shoot us, and we can travel. The third level was what I call the ceasefire, and that was you don't come in our neighborhood, we won't go in your neighborhood, you know, we won't go shooting at you, go looking for you to shoot, you don't come looking for us. And that's unfortunately about where the highest level at my three gangs that I deal with in the proposal ever got to. And that you can put all the gangs in L.A. in one of those three categories.
My guest is probation officer Jim Gallipo. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest Jim Gallipo is a probation officer with the L.A. Metropolitan Specialized Gang Unit. Do you expect that there might be violence after the verdict in the trial of the four police officers?
I expect there might be violence any time. I think in no way will it be related to the verdict in any of those trials, because nobody cares about that anymore on the streets. That's old news.
Why is that old news? Everyone assumes that that's still really
well. No,
central.
No one assumes that except the press. You know, this is a media event. You know, the people. If there's another, see the biggest thing that I'm picking up over the year being down there all the time is that it's not racial. It has nothing to do with the gangs. What it has to do with is basically upwardly, you know, striving people who feel downtrodden by the taxes, the corrupt political situation, the stagnancy of government, the inability of government to do anything. These people saw that the police in no way can protect the stores. You know, that if no matter what kind of a riot there is, they're going to be busy taking care of themselves, the firemen, their police stations. They're just numerically, L.A. has very, very few police to do the giant area in the 10 million people in Los Angeles County. I mean, we have a far lower police to population ratio than any other big city. And that's what became apparent to the citizenry of Los Angeles. Hey, I always wanted a Rolex watch. You know, now how am I ever going to afford a $12,000 watch? Never, I can dream about it. Now, there's people who are going to visit their Rolex. They know right where it is and where it's stored, and they go see it every week. And then as soon as it hits, they're going to get their Rolex. They know right where it is and, you know, the whole thing like that. Maybe they even got some backups in case somewhere that one's protected. But they know that the police are not going to be able to protect, you know, all the businesses that you know, can be easily looted.
Has anything changed for you since Willie Williams took over the Los Angeles Police Department? Is there any more respect for the police now? Or is there, and is there a more respectful police force of the community? Are there better relations between the two?
I think he is making a real effort. You know, I don't think he's doing enough. The people he talks to often are people who are fairly insulated, you know, from the streets. It's just like, for an example, in my department, you know, I have no knowledge that he has ever come and asked a street probation officer like myself what's going on. He would talk to our chief or one of our administrators who wouldn't even go down, you know, I mean, would have nothing to do with the neighborhood, and anything he knew would be fourth hand from, like, me reporting to my supervisor reporting to our director reporting to his boss, and, you know, finally it gets up there. I will look forward. I'm going to try, you know, to get some type of a time when he and I could sit down and talk. Because I go back to the riots in '65, and there's a lot of mistakes that were made then, particularly in the hiring practices of LAPD. I see the difference as being that I hope Chief Williams understands they got to start hiring a different type of officer. Right now, you have to be, you know, like, you know, practically an ex-Marine who never smoked weed and never did, you know. I mean, the type of guy that they're screening for cannot understand the streets down there.
Would you not make it past their requirements?
Oh, absolutely not. No way would I have ever made it to be an LAPD officer. I have referred guys who are ex-gang members that I know would be great cops, even all the way up to an ex-chief named Jess Brewer, one of the first black chiefs, if not the only black chief, who now is a commissioner. And he wouldn't even push this guy. And this would have been a wonderful, you know, police officer. All he's ever wanted to do since he was a kid was be a cop. He understands the gang. He speaks Spanish, you know, and all that. But the guy had a PCP arrest when he was 18 years old. And since then, he's lived a model citizen life, been a manager of a major supermarket store. He's brought his girlfriend at the time, married her. They got two children. She's a checker at the supermarket. So he'd actually probably lose money being an L.A. police officer, but all he's ever wanted to do is that. He passed the mental test. He passed the intelligence, you know, the written test. He passed everything, but he can't get by the interview. And until LAPD understands, you've got to start hiring people from the neighborhood, you know, and you got to have them work in that neighborhood, you know, then you're going to get movement.
Part of your job is to discipline people who are on probation to make sure that they keep with the rules.
Conditions of probation.
Yeah, the conditions of probation. Thank you. Do you think that discipline is a healthy thing for them? Are you glad to be imposing discipline on people who probably have not had any imposed on them before?
Well, yes, that's basically what my job is, because discipline, you know, the way I impose it, is life. trying to let them know you got to pay the consequences of your behavior. You know, you got to pay the piper. You're going to do certain things. This is the results. You know they're coming. And, you know, if I get a guy, I mean, some of the worst gang members and the craziest, I have respect for, because they say, I know I'm going to die by 19. I know what the odds are. I know this, but I'm going out in style, you know. And if they're willing to die at the hands of police, if they're willing to, you know, go to the death row, you know, in San Quentin, because, you know, they feel that it is so important for them to kill a rival gang member or to rob a liquor store, well, then don't cry about it. If you can face up like a man to it, then you and me going to get along. But see, don't come whimpering to me and crying and give me another chance and all that, because this is your chance. By the time you get to me, you are at the end of the line. I get nothing but the worst. By the time they get to me, they're the end of the line. They've already been incarcerated. They've already, you know, everything's come down to the fact that, you know, you got three ways to go out. You can die on the streets. You can, you know, you can do what I'm telling you in terms of following this course of action to get to emancipate yourself, or you can go to, you know, penitentiary or California Youth Authority, which is a junior penitentiary. Those are your three options.
You are old enough to have retired. You've been a probation officer long enough to have retired, but you're not retiring yet. Why not?
Well, because of this proposal.
What's the proposal?
The proposal is a gang abatement proposal that I wrote about 3 years ago, and they're working with me for out of Supervisor Yvonne Braithwaite Burke's office, county supervisor, to try to get funding for my proposal, which involves enfranchising really hardcore, tough OG gang members to work with me on three specific target gangs to try to bring real peace to those three gangs. And it's a paradigm that if it works there, it would work anywhere. But the programs that are ancillary to what I'm doing that I'll be using are very expensive programs. They just happen to, as God would have it, be in the neighborhoods where I need them. But they're not in any other neighborhoods. So, I mean, if this works, then I would encourage people who are, you know, the leadership of our communities that are serious about stopping gang violence, then they got to put their money where their mouth is and replicate these type of programs everywhere. And once they do it, I think we could stop Crip blood violence.
Are there any dangers for you in getting too close to the people on your caseload?
Absolutely, yeah.
So you try to keep a distance from them, even the people who you really like?
No, I don't. I just try to be objective. You know, I try to keep telling myself that same thing. And, you know, sometimes it works. Like, I had a particular young man, you know, the parts of the job that money just cannot ever replace are this type of thing. I had a guy who was one of the worst killer Hispanic gang members in South Central L.A. I had him and his younger brother, undisputed leaders of this gang. And I was on his behind every day, and I was pushing him and watching him and getting one step behind him a lot of times. And ultimately, I removed him from the home. But he was ready in his progression from a 14-year-old when I got him to, you know, he needed to go do his time, see, because that's the badge of honor, and they put the tattoo on him, show they've been in you know, camp and been in a youth authority and county jail and state prison. Well, he was, you know, waiting his turn, and he knew he was going to do it. It was just a matter of when. But I knew if this guy went to one of those institutions, he'd end up running the institution and organizing it, and we'd never be able to save him. And I saw a real qualities in him that I hoped I could use to turn other guys around. And so I just stayed in his butt, and we fought tooth and nail, and I drag him out to put him in placement facilities rather than letting him go to the institutions where he really wanted to go. So ultimately, I got him to 18 years old. He got off probation. He got a good job. And, you know, he was trying to get with the girl. He got, you know, pregnant in high school. I had one or two babies by that time. I don't know. But I got to, and he loved her. She was a beautiful young woman, and she was smart. And I got to him through her. I was able to convince her not to be with him because he's going to die. And what good is a father to your guy shot down on the streets or in a pen? You know, you can bring your babies up to see him. She had too much going for her to have a guy like that. So I convinced her, and she wouldn't marry him. and she wouldn't, you know, ultimately she wouldn't sleep with him, you know, the whole thing, and he was mad at me. And I told him, you know, it's you, it isn't me, you know, I'm telling her the truth. You want her, you got to change your life. Anyway, ultimately we ended up at a wedding 5-6 years later after, you know, it was an incredible incident where I saved him from getting killed by the sheriff. Because they wanted him for a murder that was a trumped-up murder by a rival gang, and I knew it. And I couldn't convince them, and they wanted to shoot him down anyway because of his past behavior. And, you know, I was able to save him, and I got him to commit himself to get out of the neighborhood shortly after that. And he did it. And 5 years later, you know, I get an invitation. You know, he comes by my house, they all know where I live, and left me an invitation to go to their wedding 5 years later. And so I thought, oh, this would be fun. It was back in my drinking days. So my wife and I went to the wedding, and that was a gala Mexican gang wedding, you know, the whole thing. So I was going to eat a lot and drink a lot, and that's great for me. And all of a sudden, when he gave his groom speech at the reception, he said, I'd like to have silence, please, you know. And very few guys could ever get that with a bunch of gang members. Everybody was silent. He said, I want to thank everybody for being here. I love you all. But he said, in particular, there was one man who made this possible. And I thought he was talking about his dad or his uncle or somebody. And he made me stand up. And he said, without this man, I would be dead or I'd be in a penitentiary and Carmen would never have married me. And I hated his guts for a lot of times for how he pushed me. He said, but I would not be here today if it wasn't for that man. I owe my life and my marriage to this man standing up right there. And I thought about it, you know, and he said he would not let me fail. He would not allow me to fail. And I never even considered that that's what I was doing, but that's what I do.
Jim Gallipo, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Jim Gallipo is a probation officer with the L.A. Metropolitan Specialized Gang Unit. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.